This episode brought to you by Shun Knives and Cutlery. Greetings and welcome to Quirks Outdoors. Today we have with us Lierre Keith, the author of The Vegetarian Myth, subtitle, Food Justice and Sustainability. How you doing, Lierre?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you. Now, when I got your book, I was just amazed because I read previous books, you know, that talked about what you talk about, the subject of your book, and having been a vegetarian and just vegetarian diet, and how it incorporates into the agricultural society that we've arrived at now, but you do it in a way that I really enjoy, which is you do it from a personal experience, and it's in a manner where you do pull up the research, but you don't do it in a way that either talks down, neither does it confuse, and I'd like to do, if we could share with, you know, our listeners and everything, how did you get into this?
Well, I was a very idealistic teenager, and I was somebody who was always motivated by social concerns and political concerns, and when I was 16 years old, I met somebody who was a vegan, and she laid it all out for me, this entire program of, you know, how I could save the world and be kind to animals and indeed even increase my own, you know, capacity for health and longevity if I simply became a vegan. And it's a complete package, and that makes it very appealing, especially, I think, for people who are young, for people who are teenagers. You know, when you're a teenager, your brain tends to think in black and white terms, and it seemed very simple, and it was a simple solution to a lot of problems that I saw. So I embraced it wholeheartedly, and it was really just from meeting this one person. And so I started to read all the books, all the vegetarian books, all the vegan books, and, you know, learned more statistics and more facts. And, you know, I didn't have any counter information. So all I knew was that people were starving, and this was the reason. And, you know, the world was being destroyed, and this was the reason. And it was all about, you know, how terrible it is to eat meat. So I decided I would go ahead and do this. So, you know, pretty quickly after hearing about all of it, I went ahead and, you know, declared myself a vegan and took all the animal products out and made my parents cry, and everybody was very upset about what was going to happen to me, and it turned out they were right, that their instincts about food were way better than my ideologically motivated ideas about food. But, you know, that became who I was for 20 years. And I think that one of the hardest things about having to question this is that, you know, when you're a vegan, it's not just what you eat. It really does become who you are. So it's this very intense identity. And most of the people who take it up really embrace it to that level. And the problem is that, you know, in every life there are going to be intellectual challenges and emotional challenges, even ideological challenges. And when you've made something into your identity, it becomes really hard to engage with new information because you feel very threatened. And it was a very hard thing for me to have to do. I mean, I did it for 20 years. I was a vegan. And on that last day, I mean, it was one of the hardest things I ever did was, you know, learn to eat something new. That was how it happened, was I met somebody who had, you know, information that was very, very compelling to somebody who was an idealistic teenager. So does that answer that question?
Yeah, very much so. And there was actually one point in therapy, we call it an app reaction, I think it was, where, is this the scene in your book where you're talking with, was it a radiologist or the actual doctor who deals with a lot of recovering cases of veganism that you had told him, and he says, well, you know, we all, there's death in everything and killing in the whole cycle. I think it was towards the end of the book. Was that the point where it completely flipped over for you, or was there other events before that?
That was a tough one. I developed a whole slew of physical problems, and some of them are permanent. So I did permanently damage my body. And on the very last day that I was a vegan, I went to see a Qigong healer who's a traditional Chinese medicine, and a very, very kind, very gentle, very compassionate man, and he's been doing this for, you know, 60, 70 years. And, you know, he did his thing. He, you know, sort of did the Chinese exam and took my pulses and was, you know, immediately very concerned for me and, you know, basically said, if you keep doing this, you're going to die. You've got to stop. And I sort of knew it was coming. I mean, I felt so terrible, just physically so awful, and had for so long felt that bad. But I needed somebody who was in a position of authority that I trusted to tell me that, because most of my friends at that point had already given it up. I was kind of the last holdout in my friendship circle. And so I needed to hear it from somebody that I, you know, that I trusted and respected. Mm-hmm. When he said it, I could hear it. You know, he finally, you know, it was, I knew it was going to be time. And I started crying. I mean, it was just really horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at, I'm going to have to eat meat now, and I just didn't know how I was going to do it. And he was so kind to me, but, you know, I started crying, and he said, well, do you have a religious belief? You know, what are the tears about? And I said, well, I don't want to kill anything. I don't want any animal to die for me. And he said, you know, with just this very, very gentle wisdom, he said, but the little fish eat the big fish.
Mm-hmm.
The big fish, the little fish. And I said, but I'm not a fish. And, you know, he just sort of shrugged at me with this very sweet smile and was like basically saying, you are. We all are. Every life depends on death, and mm-hmm. you're going to have to face that now. There's no way out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, and this was everything that happened after that point was trying to figure out, how do I do this ethically? And having to realize that when I was a vegan that, you know, every plate of food was loaded with death. I didn't want to face that. I didn't want to know that. I wanted to believe that my life was possible without killing anything, and it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for something to live, something else has to die. And I just pushed it out of, you know, sort of out of my view. So I didn't see the death that was on my plate, but it's absolutely there.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, with those kinds of agricultural foods, it's really the entire world that's been killed for agriculture. And that's not a way out. I didn't know that because I grew up in an urban environment. And I think after, you know, 10,000 years of agriculture, we don't even know what our planet should look like anymore. I mean, we're so used to concrete and, you know, asphalt, and we live in these completely human-built environments, and all our food comes from the store. We don't have a clue where this food comes from and what's
mm-hmm.
being killed
mm-hmm.
to produce it. I certainly didn't know. So, I mean, on one level, I want to, you know, I want to affirm that it's a good thing to question
yeah.
your culture and, you know, the cruelties that inhere inside it. And it was a good impulse for me to try to, you know, factory farming is hell for animals, and I mean, that's something we should all agree on. So that was a good impulse for me. I mean, the problem was that I got sidetracked by information that was not complete.
Mm-hmm.
And that in our culture, we don't have elders anymore, and we don't have people who can lead us down the path that really is about sustainability. And so we're left with this incomplete information, and that was what I embraced and made that into my identity. And then it became very hard. When the time came that I really had to give it up, it made it that much harder because I had to figure all this out on my own. That was not an easy process.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, and you brought up the situation with your parents, because your parents are not vegans in any form.
No, not at all. My mother was, she cried herself to sleep for like 2 years. She was
wow.
so upset. And she was right. I mean, and I had to tell her that, you know, later in life. I say in the book, it's sort of a joke, but you know you're really a grown-up when you can tell your mother that she was right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was right. I did tremendous damage to my body. And so I think that, you know, the traditional food, the kind of traditional food culture that she had inherited from her parents and grandparents was, you know, just heads and shoulders way above what I was presented with as a vegan. And you know, we're really being, all of us, led astray
mm-hmm.
by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, by the grain cartels, huge, huge, giant corporations. There's only 6 corporations essentially control the world food supply. They have a tremendous amount of power. You know, they control the government. They control these agencies. You know, they have all the money. And, you know, as usual, it's like, you know, follow the money, follow the power. So, of course, we end up with something, you know, called the food pyramid, where we're supposed to eat some ridiculous number of grain servings a day. That's the point of the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They're not there to keep us healthy. They are there to sell commodity products produced by these gigantic corporations. So, of course, they're going to tell us we should be eating cereal and bread. You know, that's how those corporations make the most money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in contrast to that, you know, you can go back to your grandparents, your great-grandparents. They didn't eat that stuff for breakfast. They ate bacon and eggs, and they were very healthy on that kind of diet. All of that's gotten vilified now, and it's really in the service of these 6 corporations that, you know, essentially control the food supply now, not just in the United States, but around the world.
And that was the thing that really just blew me away, the way you'd incorporated the history in terms of Mesopotamia. I mean, because I've read a little bit about that area and everything, and, you know, that's, you know, the Thieves of Baghdad and all that kind of stuff, which was that time and era where it was a lush,
yeah.
Gorgeous land and everything. And where did it go? And the description
yeah.
of how it just got washed away. reminds me of so many other societies and everything, where a perfect example is even in the Americas, because people think of the Native American as, you know, very well connected, but the Mayans, basically, they realize that that's one of the reasons the culture just disappeared on that level, was because they just over-agriculturized the land, and that's why that soil, even today, when you go through Central America, it doesn't really have that nutrient quality to it, because it's all been taken out by the Mayans, you know, 2,000 years ago.
We have to understand what agriculture is. And this is one of the, you know, really profound ignorances, because we live in an agricultural society. We don't understand what we're doing. But, you know, this is, you know, sort of the brute facts of agriculture is you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So you've got this tiny, tiny little number of crops, it's corn or it's rice or it's wheat, and you're growing that one crop over and over and over. And the other problem, of course, is that these crops are what are called, they're annuals. So they don't have a deep developed root system. They root very shallowly. And in order to keep producing them every year, the land has to be cleared again. Annuals only grow in cleared soil. So it's a disaster for the planet. I mean, it's a biological disaster. And every time you do that, of course, you're destroying more of the topsoil. And just to put a number on that, you know, in a bad season, in a bad year, you can destroy 2,000 years worth of topsoil with one plow crop.
Wow.
With one crop. So that's the position that we are in right now across the planet, is we've made ourselves dependent on this way of life that is essentially killing the planet. We're out of topsoil. I mean, by the year 1950, the planet was pretty well played out. And what we've been eating ever since is fossil fuel.
Mm.
What should have happened in 1950 was a, you know, natural correction in human numbers. It, you know, creates, agriculture creates this huge overpopulation wherever it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the general pattern is you get this bloated power center in the middle. You know, it takes all the resources from the surrounding area, including the soil. You know, bit by bit, everything erodes, and then the whole thing collapses, and then it pops up again somewhere else. And that's sort of the pattern that, you know, a lot of human beings have been on for the last 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a few holdouts still. There's still, you know, there's 43 tribes of remaining hunter-gatherers around the world, and, you know, they're hanging on for all they're worth, but everybody else has, you know, been defeated by the agriculturalists. And one reason is that with agriculture, since it creates a surplus, there's an entire class of people who can just be soldiers full-time. So this is when you really get militarized cultures. And it's not to say that every hunter-gatherer tribe are peaceful, because they're not. Some of them are quite warlike as well. But to have an entire class of people who only do war,
mm-hmm.
that is a product of civilization. And it's also necessary for civilization, because when you're living that way of life and you are denuding the landscape of all the resources around you, you are going to have to go out and get more. And I can guarantee you, people do not willingly give up their trees, their soil, their fish, you know, their rivers, you know, their way of life. It has to be taken by force. And, you know, the people who do that are called soldiers. So this whole way of life develops where you've got these hierarchies, you've got this military, you've got a king and a priest class at the top. And that is the pattern that civilization always follows. Every place that it's developed, that's what's happened to human culture. So it's been destructive to the planet. It's been destructive, you know, to all kinds of other creatures, you know, species that have just been wiped off the planet, you know, in service to this. And it's been very destructive to human culture as well. Because unless you're one of the top 5%, you're essentially condemned to slavery. I mean, that's, you know, up until about the year 1800, you know, the estimate is that about 80% of the population lived in some form of servitude, you know, indentured servitude or slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on the entire planet. I mean, that's 80% of the people who were alive, you know, were essentially enslaved. And that's what it takes to, you know, to do this backbreaking labor of agriculture. So, you know, that's sort of the macro version of this, is that it's, you know, if you look at the 10,000-year history of it, it's been terribly, terribly destructive to everything that it touches. And one of my favorite quotes from writer Derek Jensen, he says, "Forests precede us and deserts dog our heels." And you can see that in places like Iraq very clearly, and, you know, in the Mideast, in China, in India, in Pakistan, and certainly it's happening in the Midwest as well. But I mean, the dust storms in China are so bad now that it's literally affecting air quality in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
It's across the ocean, and then finally it hits the Rockies and it all falls down. Then you can look at places like Pakistan and India, where anywhere from 25% to 75% of the land is so degraded that it's nothing but salt flats now. The water table has dropped so far they can only get to the water using oil drilling equipment. You have to drill down a mile. And what it means, of course, is that the trees die because they can't reach the water.
Oh,
the animals
yeah.
die because mm-hmm. there's no trees. And the people get pushed off the land into urban squalor because the land has been so destroyed. And we're not really facing the depth of the problem if we don't talk about agriculture and this model of civilization as being inherently destructive processes.
And that's what I find amazing is that with all this research and all this information, is just like slaps you in the face. Is I never saw any you know, swirl or upswell in the vegetarian community or in the environmental community to hit that aspect. They're all focused on the, quote, industrial age, when long before the industrial age, it's already been happening with the destruction in the environment.
Yeah.
And they won't touch it. They won't go into it because that's their food source, they think, only. It just blew me away. And in the militancy aspect of it, too, was kind of interesting. We had talked about that with as I've been reading on the boards and everything, that there was the pie throwing event and which I was amazed because it was in the anarchist book fair, and a group of people were sitting up at the front, and then they came out of nowhere from the stage. I was watching the video, and when I read about how they described themselves, they consider themselves part of, quote, the vegetarian army, almost their own militancy. So is that innate? I mean, how would you interpret that in terms of the culture? Because I'm not a vegan, and I never will be, you know, especially after reading this book. And I've tried the diet. I mean, I tried the diets in many ways, and understand what you talk about in terms of listening to your own body is so 100% right on, because you feel that sated experience. And I've noticed it. I did a recipe about 3 weeks ago with venison. And it was just a normal lamb curry recipe, but I substituted the venison for it. And that venison curry tasted so much better than the lamb because that was an animal that had lived a full life.
Right.
You know, even though I don't know what the conditions were for that, for the sheep that it had been slaughtered for that meat in a normal recipe, but there's something about venison that's, my friends down in New Zealand, they have wild cows, and they describe the difference between wild oxen. They actually go and hunt, you know, the way we hunt wild pig here in California, where it's a wild animal. And I always describe to friends, say, if you've ever tried wild boar, you will never go back to a farm pig. And you look at a farm pig, and the pig on a farm is just, the meat looks gray. You look at wild boar, and it's almost like it's beef. Even though it's the same animal, I mean, there's, you know, one DNA strain that's a bit different, but that's it. And, it's that wildness.
It changes the nutritional quality too. And it's pretty much the same across the board, that when you let animals eat the food that they were designed for, you will get a very healthy product for human beings. And, you know, a lot of it is the kind of amino acids that are present, the kinds of proteins, and also the fats will change completely. If you are grain feeding these animals, they're not going to have enough tryptophan. And tryptophan is an amino acid that's the precursor to serotonin. So it's one reason why there's this, you know, huge epidemic of depression, is we simply don't have enough tryptophan in our diet because of the grain feeding. There's almost no tryptophan in corn. So anything that you're feeding corn to, you know, you're going to have the same problem. And, you know, meat should be really rich in these amino acids, and there's some that are missing now because of the corn feeding. And likewise, it changes the structure of the fats such that, you know, it's getting a little technical, but it's omega-6 and omega-3s, two different kinds of fats. And, you know, there's some debate about whether it should be a 1-to-1 ratio or a 2-to-1 ratio for, you know, for humans. At this point, it's at least a 20-to-1 ratio, which means there's way too many omega-6s in the American diet, and it, you know, creates all kinds of inflammatory conditions for people. I mean, everything from Alzheimer's to like schizophrenia is, you know, implicated in, you know, this overabundance of omega-6s in the diet. And some people have so few omega-3s that literally they can't find any in their blood when they do a blood test. And this is just, it's just a terrible, you know, situation for the human body, because it's just creating all this inflammation everywhere. So not a good thing. And when you eat real food, you can taste immediately something in your response. It's, you know, your brain just wakes up and goes, wow, this is what I need. And that is, it's a true thing. You know, if the animals are feeding on what they should be eating, then you will have food that is perfect for the human body. And likewise, if it's grain fed, it's not what that animal should be eating, and it's not what the human animal should be eating either. But yeah, if you want to talk about the fanatic question for a minute, it's incredibly upsetting to me that there's this whole community of people that you know, make this claim to be about justice and against oppression and against public displays of cruelty, and yet they think that assaulting me is okay. I didn't know that that community had gotten, that somehow they had found this, had come to a conclusion that that would be acceptable behavior. It's very depressing, because if that's the best strategy they've got, it's over. And if you look at history, you can see that this is where radical movements go to die. Mm-hmm. They end up assaulting each other, attacking each other instead of attacking power. Mm-hmm. We actually have a name for that. We call it horizontal hostility.
Oh, okay.
Horizontal instead of vertical. I mean, there are people who are above us in the pyramid. They do have power, and they are doing terrible things on this planet, and they need to be stopped. But instead of actually having, you know, direct action of, you know, whatever kind, you know, to try to change the world more toward justice, you know, what happens is people attack each other. And mm-hmm. so if you're not going to hit up, you're only going to hit across. And that's what they did to me. So it's not going to work. I have no power. I'm not the one who's in charge of all this destruction. And I'm also not going to stop talking, because, you know, what's at stake is too big. So I'm going to keep saying that agriculture is destroying the planet, and I am going to keep, you know, advocating for what I am advocating for. So on that level, it was kind of a useless activity, but it's just very disturbing that, you know, they think that some kind of public display of cruelty is, you know, in some way going to bring about a just world. And the whole thing was just, I find that very upsetting, that coming from people who make this claim to virtue, this kind mm-hmm. of moral claim
exactly.
To wanting a just world. You know, and the only thing I can say sort of from the other side is that I understand the fanatic impulse, mm-hmm. and I know that the world only changes by that kind of monomaniacal, you know, sort of passion. And you know, the problem is it's been misdirected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, they're not aimed at the right people. But if, you know, if you're really going to bring that kind of passion to bear, you've got to have a much better strategy than just getting somebody you don't like to shut up. I mean, it's just a useless adolescent sort of activity. So.
I mean, I've noticed in myself, hunters will really, understand and appreciate it, because, I mean, there are even laws now against that type of harassment against
right.
hunters when they're out in the field. And it's, the irony of it is that most of these anti-hunting groups put no money whatsoever into the protection of wildlife areas for game. And
right.
it's actually the hunters. And that's why I say, you know, if there's one way that that anti-hunters can completely turn every animal extinct, is to wipe out all the hunters, because all the money that's being put in is not by the anti-hunters, but by the hunters through taxation, at least through the 30s, and through respect for those who understand, you know, and respect the land in terms of what it offers in terms of game and fish for hundreds, thousands of years. And that's, I think, that what I really appreciate about your book is that you brought that that understanding of the hunter-gatherers and that appreciation, that true connection that you have to the field, and to the game that's being killed, that's been going on for thousands of years, and especially through that hunter-gatherer society, that
right.
In our modern society now, that we've become so disconnected. It just, I mean, we're the same age and everything, and just to have watched even the last 30 years to see how much of a shift, say, someone who's in their 20s, mainly because they just haven't had that opportunity to even be out in the woods,
yeah.
you know, because of our technology and how it's like, they talk about obesity, you know, because kids are hanging up in front of the video games. And that's an amazing phenomenon. That a friend of mine, he's a fanatic bow hunter. He likes to go out and get game for his family and everything. But his son would be out there, you know, in the living room watching and playing the video games and missing an opportunity to go out in the field with his father. And that kind of awareness is just lost.
Even a generation ago, most people had at least one connection back to a rural area.
Mm-hmm.
That chain has gotten broken. You know, the chain of generations has been snapped. And now almost everybody, you know, it's lost. There's almost nobody left who has a family farm in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Only 2% of the population is actually involved in farming. And most of that involves, you know, being inside a giant tractor and just in an air-conditioned tiny little room, you know, cruising up and down the row crop of, you know, corn or soybeans for Monsanto. It's not actual farming. I mean, it's an industrial process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So even the people who do have, you know, access to, quote, a farm, it's not the kind of farm that, you know, you and I might remember from, you know, our grandparents' time. So So, and the land has been taken. You know, it's all been turned into suburbs. So, whereas before, even if you lived in a city, you could at least get to a rural area pretty quickly. You could take a subway or, you know, a trolley car. You could ride on your bike even. You could get to where there was a stream or where there was, you know, some kind of little woodland. And that's just over for kids now. You can't get anywhere without a car, which means your parents have to take you. And it's usually like an all-day trip to get anywhere where there might be some wild land. So between the suburban sprawl and, you know, the way that the economy has been, you know, completely, the rural economy has been broken. Those rural communities are under such assault by all of this. It's, we don't have that personal connection anymore. So it means that there's this, you know, on a whole other level, there's these children who are so profoundly alienated from the natural world. I think the last thing I read was the average child spends something like 4 minutes outside every day.
Yeah.
I was a kid, we at least ran around the neighborhood. I mean, you know, it was the suburbs, but there were some trees and we did see rabbits once in a while. And, you know, and then my mom would take us down the shore and we'd, you know, at least have some time on the beach every summer, but, and my grandparents lived in a more rural area, but, that's gone from those kids. I mean, how are they gonna know? I mean, I don't even know what ants are or, you know, what's a spider? Like, just the real basic kinds of things that you should be interacting with, you know, on a regular basis. It's gone. And there's nothing but cement now for these kids. And you know, you really just, it's not even just their emotional development, it's like their souls. You know, you've got to worry for this generation on a really profound level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we talked a little bit about the physical response of your body to the diet that you had. I mean, basically it really hollowed out your skeletal system and also weakened your musculature. Is that correct?
Well, I ultimately ended up with degenerative disc disease in my spine. You know, my basic sort of structure just fell apart. My spine's basically collapsing in on itself. And so I live with constant pain. I really, at this point, at the very end of being a vegan, that was sort of the worst moment. At that point, I could only sit up for about 20 minutes at a time. I spent almost all day lying in bed. It was on the couch. And I only stood up when I absolutely had to. And it was, you know, just a tremendous amount of physical pain. The disease that I had does not get better. I mean, everybody says that, you know, it's a one-way ticket. This is not a part of the body that can really repair itself. And in fact, I've gotten a kind of minor miracle because by learning to eat meat again and appropriate dairy products, which is stay raw and pasture fed, my spine actually has repaired quite a bit. So my life is just immensely expanded, from, you know, the pain shrinking. And so at this point I can sit up for a few hours at a time and I can stand for about a half an hour. It's a way bigger life and a way better life. And I mean, that level of pain was just, it was fairly hellish. And, you know, suicide was always an option. You try not to go there, but it was really hard, you know, to live such a constrained and such a life that was really, I mean, it's like I was the shadow and pain was the life. And that's flipped, you know, like I have my life back. There will always be physical constraints, but it's not like it was. And so that was, you know, one of the major things that went wrong. I also ended up with an autoimmune disease. So I have Hashimoto's disease, which is an autoimmune disease of the thyroid. And that is very much about wheat, wheat soy especially. And when you have an autoimmune disease, you really can never eat gluten products again. And this is one of the things that's very clear in the archaeological record, both of those things, that the moment people start eating agricultural foods, they shrink 6 inches, their bones are riddled with disease, and they get what are called the diseases of civilization. So it's cancer, diabetes, autoimmune disease, degenerative diseases, that whole constellation of sort of heart disease and, you know, what they call metabolic syndrome. And all of that ultimately is from eating grain instead of eating, you know, traditional animal fats and animal proteins. We are designed for dense, but nutrient-dense animal food.
Yeah.
And when all you give the body is essentially sugar, which is, you know, wheat or corn or rice, you're going to fall apart. It's not what we were meant to eat. So those are the two main things that went wrong. I had a lot of sort of minor things that fell apart along the way. Those have all repaired by that. I ended up with gastroparesis in my stomach, and I had terrible problems with my reproductive system from the soy. And that was a miracle that happened in 2 weeks. I went cold turkey on soy products, and 2 weeks later I was fine. I mean, just absolutely cleared up overnight practically.
Wow.
That was like, I mean, it could not have been more dramatic. And so when I talk about, you know, I have a whole rant about soy that I do, and there's a lot about it in my book.
It was amazing. When I read that, I was just, I mean, I can't, I mean, as I had said, I was raised in Asia, and tofu and soy is just so interlaced into the culture and everything, but now it's like I can't even think about going, you know, and having, because they have like a recipe, like in a dim sum would be like a fried, tofu bricks.
Right.
You know,
right.
With the miso sauce on it and soy sauce right. on it. And when you describe the effects, especially with memory loss and your description of the person who had requested you come over, and she didn't even remember, and it took that long of a time period for her to finally recognize what she had called you over for, that just blew me away.
And I've seen that repeatedly with people. I mean, people who are in their 20s and mm-hmm. have these tremendous memory problems, and, you know, then they always say, oh, I'm addicted to soy. And, you know, it's like, well, let me tell you what I know about soy, and you can take it or leave it, but I know why you don't have a memory anymore. You're not 90. You're only 25.
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't be, you know, not able to remember people's phone numbers and, you know, forget what you're doing on Tuesday night. But the soy, you know, the soy also, especially the soy that we're eating, I mean, they're highly processed industrial waste products, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wanted the oil to use for various industries, and then they've got this sort of protein glop that's left over. And what can we do with this? How do we market this? And there's tons of it, you know, produced every year.
Mm-hmm.
And there were memos that were leaked from the 70s where, you know, the soy board hired a public relations firm who said, well, if we can position this as a green, groovy product, so, you know, middle-class people who do yoga, essentially, we'll have won the battle. You know, we'll make everybody think this is a desirable food instead of, you know, I mean, in the 70s, people sort of rolled their eyes at it. It was, you know, filler for poor people and, you know, stuff that got fed to people in prison. It was a joke, you know, but now, of course, it's got this green veneer on it, and that's solely marketing. I mean, it's the same stuff still, right?
Yeah.
But they've been able to convince everybody that, you know, somehow this is good for them and good for the planet. And again, it's an industrial waste product by and large. The traditional soy that they eat in Asia, you know, if you want to eat soy, that would be the way to do it. So miso, highly fermented. And by fermenting it, you do take out some of the anti-nutrients. It's a little more digestible. It's also eaten with fish broth usually, though, and there's a reason for that. You know, that soy is very damaging to the thyroid, and fish broth is very supportive of the thyroid. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of iodine. Another problem with soy is that it has a lot of these substances called phytates, and phytates are one of the ways that plants fight back. They don't want to be eaten.
Mm-hmm.
And phytates will bind with minerals in the human digestive tract and take the minerals out. So you can end up really, you know, with damaged bones and joints like I did for that very reason. You know, you're not getting enough minerals, and the few that you are getting sucked out by the phytates. When you ferment soy, and when you ferment other grains as well, you actually disable all of those phytates.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it more digestible. It means you can absorb more minerals. So again, a product like miso, it's fermented, so they figured that out. And it's eaten with fish broth, so they figured that part of it out.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of traditional cultures have this kind of wisdom where who knows how they figured it out. I mean, they didn't have microscopes, but they did realize if we do this, it'll be more digestible. It won't hurt us as much. So if you want to eat a little miso with your fish broth, you know, I don't think that's going to kill anybody, but, you know, the kinds of things we're being told to eat, these meat analog products, the soy milk, this stuff is just horrifying. When you find out how it's made, you'll never eat it again. My sister had endometriosis from eating soy products. She had to have a hysterectomy, so this is very serious. And my little step nephew almost died. They put him on soy formula, infant formula, and when he was a few months old, he went into anaphylactic shock and almost died from the formula.
Yeah.
So I've seen this in my own family in some pretty profound ways. And soy is one of those things I don't take prisoners on. I mean, if, I will go on and on about soy because I'm pretty horrified by what has happened to people's health in this country and around the world. And this is all for, you know, ADM and Monsanto and a bunch of people that in any other circumstance we would recognize do not have our interests at heart. And they're absolutely gigantic corporations. It's all based on, you know, pretty poisonous substances like Roundup. We know what they've done to, you know, farm country and how they've, you know, taken over all those economies and essentially turned people into serfs who used to be, you know, tradespeople and, you know, honest farmers. And what they produce is this food that's basically inedible and will disrupt people's health. But they've sold it to us as if it's something wonderful. You know, in every step of the way, this is a very bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it just surprises me that people who are environmentalists or consider themselves leftists, when it comes to soy, they won't question. And I don't know why. Because in any other instance, they would recognize, you know, the power differentials that are going on here, the kind of destruction that's happening to, you know, to human community and to the earth community. And yet, we're all supposed to eat soy as, you know, some kind of a, you know, a it's somehow going to fix the situation, and it's not. I mean, it's one of the worst things that's happening on the planet right now. So that's my soy rant.
Yeah, that thing about the soy and the, because I'd seen a documentary on TV about the process they were doing filming in China about the, yeah. That was the first time I actually saw the process of creating tofu, and it just blew me away how much refining was involved in this recipe that's, you know, more than 1,000 years old.
Right.
And still that had that type of reaction. And then now presently, it's my little joke with my friends. I say, hey, you know, I'll drink a soda anywhere else except the U.S. because
right.
my big thing is high fructose corn syrup.
Oh, yeah.
I am so against that. And no other country will permit the United, you know, will allow those sodas to be sold in their country. Even the point, I went to a Mexican restaurant in Gilroy down the South Bay. And I went in there and I noticed that there were these old Coke bottles. And I found out from the owner, he says, yeah, they only sell Coca-Cola from Mexico in there. And you see right on there two things. One is it tastes different. It tastes like the old Coca-Cola that we remember as kids. Secondly, that it did not have the same type of feeling where it's kind of like when I eat beef or chicken, that's when I compare the taste between chicken and beef in the U.S. and chicken and beef, let's say, in Vietnam or in Southeast Asia. The beef and meat from farm-raised animals in Asia is... it rejuvenates. People feel
right.
stronger when they eat it. When when you have it here, it creates sometimes that feeling of, God, why do I feel so kind of drained and everything? And when you describe how that grain feeding affects the meat, and it's kind of like I'm a very strong believer in the fact of, you know, you eat, what you eat is what you are, but also what you eat and what they eat is what you are.
That's very true.
And that is amazing in how we've just completely flipped things over. And we can go back, you know, into the history with free, you know, cheap corn back to the Nixon administration. And that's when they started that.
Yeah.
And the high fructose corn syrup and everything. But it's just we've gotten so far away from what made our grandparents so physically strong. You know, they talk about, you know, our great-grandparents and our grandparents, God, the things that they had to go through, you know, going to school and working on the farm. And I go, well, yeah, you know, think also about what they were eating in contrast to what we eat now.
I know. I mean, nobody on Special K and skim milk is going to get through anything.
No.
You know, in a morning. I mean, you can't concentrate in school. You can't get up and run around. You certainly couldn't walk 10 miles through the snow on a breakfast like that. You know, it's nothing but sugar.
No way. And I mean, that reminds me of high school, you know, where I was always complaining. My parents have said, you know, and I was really heavy in high school because I was always having cereal and milk, cereal and milk, cereal and milk. When I should have been, just like you're saying, I should have been having, you know, steak and eggs or something like that. As an adult, yeah, better shape, more energy. And thinking about what you were physically in terms of going through the vegetarian diet, your dream, diet and way of life now, how would you describe something like that in contrast?
Well,
what would you envision?
I've been pretty successful at finding food that I'm happy with, you know, in my local area. I have to go a little further afield for some of it. But I eat almost exclusively grass-fed meat. It's important to me ethically and ecologically, but also with my health conditions, it's not really an option to eat anything else at this point. I really have to stick to the grass feeding.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm lucky that I live in a rural area, and there are farmers who understand this. And it's really great to watch these ideas spread and to know that even 5 years ago, it was much harder to find these kinds of foods, but now you really can find farmers who are doing it, and they're making a living at it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was just reading how that most farmers who switch to grass feeding can make a living the very first year they can turn a profit. And I find that really helpful. I mean, on a planetary scale, on a global scale, even just the United States, if we took all the trashed out agricultural land that's east of the Dakotas and we put it back into pasture,
mm-hmm.
and put it back to the grassland, the prairie that we'd really like to be, and graze it with appropriate ruminants, that land, I mean, that what grass can do, what prairie can do, is so astounding because it builds topsoil really quick. And the basic building block is carbon. So the punchline on this is if we could take that land, put it back into pasture, into prairie, the United States would immediately become a net carbon sink.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what everybody's still driving, you know, those great big cars and their SUVs and stuff. If we could do this around the entire globe, if we could take 75% of the trashed out agricultural land and put it back into grasslands, it would only take maybe 10, 15 years, and we could sequester all of the carbon that's been released since the beginning of the industrial age, all of it, 15 years. That's what we have to do. And I just feel like the environmental movement is missing this tremendous opportunity, and it's getting scarier and scarier. You know, the carbon keeps rising. The governments aren't doing anything. Well, this is something we can do, and it's something we can all do really directly where we live. You know, ask the farmers in your area to switch to grass feeding. Tell them that you will buy these products ahead of time. You know, you can order up in January for, you know, the beef that you're going to get in October. And that really helps farmers, you know, to know that that money is there. And, you know, to say that they can make money the first year. I mean, people are tired of being serfs in farm country. You know, tell them that you'll go ahead and buy those products. And, you know, around the world, this would give people back their sovereignty, their communal way of life could come back, their traditional life ways, everything that's been destroyed, you know, in the service of corporate America, as well as, you know, sequestering all that carbon. And it also creates habitat for wildlife. It could save the rivers, which are being destroyed right now between, you know, the wash of the topsoil and, you know, the depth of the trees. The rivers are just in such bad shape around the world. And all of this could be reversed if we would just get it right, mm-hmm. if we would give up this project of agriculture and let the world be, you know, the grass and the forest that it wants to be, take our place again. We don't have to be destroying monsters. We really could be participants in the cycle of life once more and, you know, be humble and joyful in that process. So that's where I get my hope. Where I get my food is, you know, these local farms, and some of them are doing absolutely everything right. I can get really great pastured pork. I can get wonderful pastured beef. There's even some bison farms not too far from where I live.
Excellent.
And they make, like, you know, pepperoni and sausage and stuff I adore, so that's great. I do have a hard time getting raw milk where I live because it's not legal, and that's a problem. But, you know, I'm in
what
the
state
underground.
Is this?
What's that?
What state is this?
I'm living in Northern California right now, and in Humboldt County, you cannot get raw milk. It's not legal.
Huh.
So, yeah, when I lived in Massachusetts, I watched this whole process happen because when I started eating this way, raw milk was not legal yet, or it was only legal county by county. You know, each county had to make a decision about it.
Wow.
So it was not legal where I lived, and people changed it. You know, they changed the laws. They made it be possible. They got all these principles, and I watched these farms just spring to life all around me because instead of selling, you know, the pasteurized, grain-fed, terrible milk to, you know, these distributors, the sort of middleman producers of the whole thing, they can only get about 15 cents a gallon. But if they can sell direct from the farm, and if they're selling a product like grass-fed raw milk,
mm-hmm.
people will come to the farm. I mean, I would go.
Yeah.
And you can get $6 a gallon. So the difference between 15 cents a gallon and $6 a gallon, that's your mortgage. That's your kid's college education. That's the roof on the house. I mean, that's everything. That's a huge amount of money. So all these farms were able to really make a living again. And I hope this happens in Northern California as well. It's really a drag not being able to get raw milk because I'm back in the underground.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the joke in Humboldt, I mean, I don't know how much you know about Humboldt, but I mean, I can score any drug. You know, within 5 minutes in downtown Humboldt, in downtown Arcata or Eureka, but I can't get raw milk. I mean, it's crazy, you know?
Yeah.
So I have to get cheese from out of state. I have to buy cheese from other places, but I'm hoping that will change, you know, with time. People are working on it, and, you know, we could bring that back to the area as well. It would be good. So I'm pretty happy with my food supply here because I've got, you know, I've got my meat, and I've got my, got really great eggs from a wonderful farm. It would be better if I could get, you know, milk more locally, but I'm making do. That's really the basis of, you know, what I'm eating right now. I wish that I had wild game as well, because I know that there are definitely, you know, lots of rural areas to hunt around here, but I'm not in any physical shape to be able to do that, which mm-hmm. is, you know, one of those sad things I have to live with. I would really like to be more of a participant in, you know, getting deer or quail or turkey or something, you know, that I could take part in, you know, the actual killing and, you know, doing that part of it and doing it well. As a sense, I can't quite, but, you know, maybe someday if I keep improving, that could be something that I learn to do, because it doesn't feel right to me not to be part of it. So.
And that's that thing, it's that connection that to nature that, yeah, you can hike in the woods and everything, but when you realize that you actually get food and sustenance from those same woods that the other person who's just a hiker and just looking around, that you have that connection to the woods, I mean, doesn't that make you feel that you have that much more, even more responsibility on an even deeper subconscious to support that, that environment that, I think that's one of the reasons that we have a lot of people who they think it's nice and they put money there, but do they really have that deep heart connection to say, whoa, you know, stop this, you know, you're tearing up this land area that could support food for a whole bunch of people.
I totally agree. I think it's pretty prime in terms of what's going on in the culture. And, yeah, you know, if you're dependent on the forest or you're dependent on the river for your life and you're a member of that sort of biotic community, then you will defend it with your life because you know where your sustenance comes from. And right now, most people's sustenance comes from, you know, the grocery store with the asphalt parking lot. So even if they hate being dependent on it, they're stuck defending it because anything else is too terrifying. Like, how will I survive if there's no bank card and no supermarket? And that, you know, it keeps us sort of enslaved in this system that is pretty well devouring the whole planet. And you know, we're going to have to learn to stop it, but it's hard for people to make that leap when they're dependent on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Lear, I want to thank you very much for being on the show, and I want to remind people that the title of the book is The Vegetarian Myth. Subtitle is Food, Justice, and Sustainability, and it was written by Lear, and that's L-I-E-R-R-E, Keith, K-E-I-T-H, and I hope everybody goes out and gets a copy and reads about it, and especially if you do have any family members that might even be thinking about following a vegan diet, I would hope that you would get a copy for him or her, and please have them read it, because I think you'll save them a lot of pain in the future. So thank you again, and I wish you the best with your book.
Thank you.
For the latest episode of Cork's Outdoors Radio or for prior shows, please visit www.corksoutdoors.com.